This deep dive is brought to you by CertFuel. They've got a full Series 66 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and, you know, unlimited practice exams weighted just like the real thing. Check it out at CertFuel.com.
Definitely worth a look if you're prepping.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's just jump right in. When you hear a company is, like, going public, who do you think actually gets the first bite at the apple?
Right. Who gets to scoop up those shiny new shares?
Exactly. At that original offering price you see printed in the financial papers?
Yeah.
You
know?
Well, spoiler alert, it is probably not who you think it is,
okay.
And it is definitely not you.
No, definitely not.
Today is all about equity public offerings. We are going to master initial public offerings, secondary offerings, and those completely wild financial structures known as SPACs.
I mean, these concepts really form the absolute backbone of the capital markets. Public offerings are that tightly regulated gateway between the opaque private markets and the highly visible public exchanges. If you're taking the Series 66, you have to understand the actual mechanics, like how these securities get created, how they physically reach the market, and perhaps most critically for the regulators, who's left holding the bag when things go catastrophically wrong.
And things go wrong a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But before we plunge into those mechanics, let's just break the fourth wall for a second here.
Let's do it.
We know your situation. You are studying. You want to pass this exam. And if you have a learning style like mine, you know, with ADHD, your brain just completely checks out the second someone starts doing a monotone reading of federal securities regulation.
No, for sure. It's brutal.
It really is. So we're actively avoiding that trap today. To help you visualize all these moving parts without falling asleep, we're going to populate this deep dive with a cast of recurring characters.
I love this approach.
Yeah, think of it like a cinematic universe, but specifically designed to help you crush questions about the Securities Act of 1933.
It creates a concrete anchor. I mean, when the exam throws a convoluted multi-paragraph scenario at you about underwriting risks, you won't be trying to recall a wall of text.
Exactly. You'll just picture our characters.
Right. And you'll just ask yourself what their specific motivations are.
So let's meet the roster. First up, we have Frank, the founder. Frank is this eccentric visionary who has just invented a revolutionary product motorized dolphin shoes.
Motorized dolphin shoes. Wow.
Don't ask how they work. Okay. Just know they are incredibly dangerous, highly sought after, and literally everybody wants a pair.
Naturally.
Then we have Ursula, the underwriter. She is a constantly stressed, impeccably dressed investment banker. She has to somehow package and sell Frank's fever dream to the public without getting her firm sued.
A very tough job.
Very. And finally, we have Retail Randy. He's your everyday retail investor, you know, sitting at home in his sweatpants, trading on his phone, furiously refreshing his brokerage app to get in on the action.
Now, we should probably introduce Ivan, the institutional investor, too.
Oh, yes. Good call.
Ivan runs a $50 billion pension fund. He doesn't buy 10 shares on an app, right? He buys 10 million shares over a private phone line. He is the whale that Ursula is actually trying to court.
Perfect. So we have our cast. Let's look at the IPO baseline. Frank's motorized dolphin shoe company is currently private. He owns it entirely, maybe alongside a few venture capitalists who funded his early garage prototypes.
Right, but Frank has hit a wall now.
Exactly. He wants to build a massive state-of-the-art manufacturing facility in Nevada. He wants to expand globally. And he also has some high-interest debt. He really needs to clear off his balance sheet.
So to get that massive influx of capital, we are talking hundreds of millions of dollars, he needs to do an initial public offering.
Right.
He needs to transform his private, closely held company into a publicly traded one.
And that transformation relies on one fundamental concept that you absolutely must have etched into your memory for the exam, the primary market.
Yes. The word primary is the absolute linchpin of this entire process. An IPO is a primary offering because the issuer, which is Frank's company, is the entity creating the new shares.
Creating them out of thin air.
Right. Creating them, selling them, and directly receiving the proceeds from that sale. The money flows straight from the investor's pockets into Frank's corporate treasury.
I just want to make that exceptionally clear because it trips people up. The term primary has nothing to do with time.
Exactly. It doesn't just mean first.
Right. It means the company itself is the beneficiary of the cash. Primary equals company gets the money. New shares are being spoken into existence for the very first time.
which expands the total number of shares in the world. And that expansion is critical to understand. Because new shares are being created, a primary offering is inherently dilutive to the existing owners.
Okay, let's break that down. Dilutive how?
Well, Frank owned 100% of the company when it had, say, 1 million shares, right? And then the company issues another 1 million brand new shares to the public in the IPO. Frank now only owns 50% of the company.
Ah, I see.
His slice of the pie stayed the exact same size in absolute terms, but the pie itself just doubled.
That is such a good visual. We will come back to dilution later because the exam loves testing your intuition on that. But now let's go back to that question I asked you in the hook.
The first bite of the apple.
Yeah. I'm going to pause and give you a beat to answer this for yourself. If Frank's company goes public, who actually gets to buy the shares at that original offering price?
Think about it for a second.
So I used to assume it was just a free-for-all, you know.
Mm.
The bell rings at 9:30 a.m., and whoever clicks buy fastest on their app gets the shares at the IPO price.
I mean, that's what everyone thinks, but it is entirely divorced from reality.
Completely divorced. The general public rarely gets first dibs. That original offering price, let's say they priced the motorized dolphin shoes at $15 a share, that is largely reserved for Ivan, the institutional investor.
Exactly. When Frank's company goes public, Ursula the underwriter allocates the vast, vast majority of those initial shares to Ivan and her other massive, high net worth clients.
I feel like we need to explain the why here, because otherwise it just sounds like this massive Wall Street conspiracy against retail Randy.
It does sound like that, yeah.
So why does Ursula give all the $15 shares to Ivan instead of spreading them around to normal people?
It really just comes down to stability and risk management. Ursula's job is to guarantee that she can sell millions of shares and raise the capital Frank needs.
Right. She has a quota to hit.
Exactly. So who's easier to rely on? A million retail Randys who might get spooked by a bad tweet and cancel their $100 orders at the last second?
Which happens all the time.
Right. Or one Ivan who signs a binding agreement to buy a $50 million block of stock and actually hold it.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Ursula goes to her best, most reliable, deepest pocketed clients. Ivan gets the allocation because he provides the institutional bedrock the offering needs to actually succeed.
So where does that leave retail Randy sitting on his couch with his trading app?
He generally has to wait for the secondary market. What happens mechanically is that Ivan buys the shares directly from the underwriting syndicate at that $15 offering price.
Okay, at like 8:00 a.m. before the market opens.
Right. Then, when the stock officially starts trading on the open exchange later that morning, Ivan might decide to sell some of his position or other market makers step in. That is when retail Randy can finally buy them.
But Randy's buying them at whatever price supply and demand dictate at that exact second, right?
Exactly. If the financial media has hyped up these dolphin shoes to a fever pitch, the demand will heavily outweigh the supply. Randy might end up paying $30 a share on the open market at 10:00 a.m., even though Ivan got them for $15 just 2 hours earlier.
This is exactly where the test writers set a trap. I mean, they will try to get you here. The Series 66 might present a true-false statement like, an IPO is open to the public, meaning any retail investor is guaranteed access to shares at the initial offering price.
Which is absolutely false. Do not fall for that.
Right.
The phrase open to the public simply describes the legal regulatory status of the shares. It means the company has registered the securities with the SEC, transforming them into a public security that anyone is legally permitted to buy and sell on the open market.
Ah, legally permitted, not guaranteed access.
Exactly. It has absolutely zero bearing on how an investment bank actually chooses to allocate its inventory. Do not conflate the legal definition of a public offering with the practical reality of Wall Street allocations.
That is a huge takeaway. Okay, let's trace this back a step. We know Frank needs money. Yeah. We know Ivan has money. But Frank can't just cold call a $50 billion pension fund and say, hey, want to buy some equity in my weird dolphin shoes startup?
No, Ivan would hang up immediately.
Exactly. They need a middleman. They need the kitchen where this whole meal is prepped, cooked, and plated. So enter Ursula's world.
Ursula represents the underwriter, the investment bank. Frank hires her firm to manage this incredibly complex, legally perilous process from start to finish, and it truly is grueling.
So grueling.
The underwriting process generally involves four massive phases, and the first is due diligence.
I want to dig into due diligence because I was reading up on the Securities Act of 1933, specifically Section 11, and it seems like due diligence isn't just a corporate buzzword, right?
No, it's not.
It is a strict legal defense.
Mm.
So what is Ursula actually doing in this phase?
She is essentially conducting a forensic audit of Frank's entire existence. The underwriter has to investigate the company's financials, its supply chain, its executive team, pending lawsuits, every conceivable risk factor.
Right. So if those motorized dolphin shoes have a slight tendency to short circuit and catch fire when exposed to salt water.
Which is bad for a water shoe.
Right. Ursula needs to uncover that fact and explicitly document it.
Because if she doesn't, and the company goes public, and a shoe catches fire, the investors will sue. And they won't just sue Frank.
No, they're going after the deep pockets.
Exactly. They will sue Ursula's investment bank for misrepresenting the company and omitting material facts. The only way Ursula's firm can defend themselves in court is to prove they conducted a reasonable, exhaustive investigation, a quote-unquote due diligence defense.
So she brings in just armies of lawyers and accountants to tear Frank's business apart before they ever file a single piece of paper with the government.
That's phase one. Once she's satisfied that she knows every skeleton in Frank's closet, they move to phase two, SEC registration.
The paperwork phase.
Ursula helps Frank prepare and file the massive registration statement, officially known as Form S-1. This is the telephone book-sized document that tells the government, and eventually the public, everything they could possibly need to know about the business.
The financials, the risks, the specific terms of the stock offering, all of it.
Right. And then phase three is pricing.
Okay, I want to challenge something here. Because this concept gets heavily tested and honestly frequently misunderstood. Doesn't the free market set the price of a stock? Why is Ursula, an investment banker, the one setting the price?
That's a great question. We really have to separate the offering price from the trading price.
Okay.
The underwriter, Ursula, sets the initial offering price before the stock ever hits the public exchange. How does she do that? She runs complex, discounted cash flow models. She compares Frank's company to similar publicly traded shoe companies.
If there are any.
Right. And most importantly, she goes on a roadshow. She travels around the country pitching the company to institutional investors like Ivan.
To gauge their appetite.
Exactly. If Ivan says, I'd buy 1 million shares at $14, but I won't touch it at $16, Ursula takes all that data and determines the optimal clearing price. Let's say she finalizes that offering price at $15.
But the second the stock hits the New York Stock Exchange or the NASDAQ.
The second trading begins, Ursula's $15 price is entirely irrelevant. The free market takes over. Supply and demand dictate the trading price minute by minute.
Right, it could soar to $50 or plummet to $5.
Exactly. But if an exam question asks who determines the IPO offering price, the answer is the underwriter in consultation with the issuer. It is never determined by the exchange, and it is most certainly never determined by the SEC.
Okay, which brings us to the final phase, phase four, distribution. Actually selling those newly minted shares to investors through a syndicate.
Right.
And a syndicate is just, a team of multiple broker-dealers who band together to share the risk of selling a massive offering.
And this distribution phase is where the Series 66 exam loves to confuse candidates with terminology. They will give you a scenario and ask you to identify the specific role a person or entity is playing.
Oh, man.
You have to differentiate between an issuer, a broker-dealer, an agent, a dealer, and a rating agency. They can blur together if you aren't paying strict attention.
Okay, let's pull them apart side by side because I need to keep this straight, starting with the issuer.
Simple enough. The issuer is Frank's company. They are the entity creating the new securities. They are the ones who ultimately received the capital in a primary offering.
Got it. If the exam question describes an entity raising capital by offering its own securities to the public, you select issuer.
Correct. Next is the broker-dealer. In our universe, that is Ursula's firm. Not Ursula the human, but the giant investment bank she works for.
Right, the corporate entity.
Their responsibility is acting as the intermediary, distributing the securities to the public. They are the bridge between Frank and the investors.
But what if we zoom in on Ursula herself? What if the exam asks about the human being who picks up the telephone, calls Ivan, and physically executes the sale of those shares?
Then she is acting as an agent. Give this a lot of attention because the distinction between a broker-dealer and an agent is a classic stumbling block.
Yeah, I've messed that up before.
An agent is always a natural person, a living, breathing human being, an individual representing a broker-dealer or an issuer in effecting securities transactions.
So an agent is never a firm, an LLC, or a corporation?
Never. If the question asks about a natural person executing trades on behalf of others, the answer is an agent.
Okay, moving down the list, what about a dealer?
A dealer is a firm acting in a principal capacity.
Let me jump in and explain the difference between a broker and a dealer, because it's literally baked right into the name broker-dealer, and it used to confuse me so much.
Go for it.
When a firm acts as a broker, they are just matching a buyer and a seller, right?
Yep.
And they charge a commission for making the introduction. They take no risk.
Exactly.
But when a firm acts as a dealer, they are buying and selling securities for their own account, using their own money, and holding the securities in their own inventory.
Yes.
They make a profit on the markup or markdown. They are taking a position and taking on actual risk.
Excellent breakdown. Finally, the test writers love to throw rating agency into the multiple choice options as a distractor. Think of like Moody's or Standard & Poor's.
Why is this a trap?
Because a rating agency has absolutely nothing to do with issuing or distributing equity.
Oh, right.
A rating agency assigns credit risk ratings to debt issues like corporate bonds. They tell investors the likelihood of a company defaulting on its debt. They do not underwrite stock IPOs.
So if you get a question about a company raising capital by selling equity, and rating agency is listed as an option for who manages the distribution, just eliminate it immediately. It is purely there to distract you.
Exactly.
So we have our definitions locked in. Let's go back to the timeline. Frank and Ursula have completed their due diligence. They have drafted the massive S-1 registration statement. They physically submitted to the Securities and Exchange Commission. Are they ready to start selling shares the next morning?
Not even close. Filing the registration statement triggers the beginning of a phase officially known as the 20-day cooling-off period.
Unofficially, it is purgatory.
Purgatory is the perfect word for it. Mm. Once that S-1 is filed, the offering enters a mandatory waiting period. By law, it must be at least 20 days before the registration can become effective and shares can legally be sold.
The history here is pretty fascinating. Why 20 days?
Well, back in 1933, everything was on paper. The SEC needed time to physically receive the documents, read through them, and ensure all the required financial disclosures were actually present. At the same time, it gave the investing public a literal cooling-off period to review the information without being subjected to high-pressure sales tactics.
It was designed to prevent those boiler room brokers from calling a client and forcing them to buy a new stock on the spot before they even had time to research it.
Exactly.
Let me throw a hypothetical scenario at you to test the mechanics of this timeline.
Yeah.
Let's say we are on day 15 of the cooling off period. Okay.
Okay.
The SEC reviewers are reading through Frank's S-1 filing and they notice something wrong. Maybe he forgot to include his debt to equity ratio, or maybe his description of the dolphin shoes battery life is misleading. What happens to the 20-day clock?
It stops immediately. The SEC will issue a deficiency letter, sometimes called a comment letter, to Frank and Ursula. They outline everything that is missing or unclear.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. So Frank and Ursula then have to draft an amendment to the S-1 to fix those specific issues.
Boy.
When they file that amendment with the SEC, the 20-day clock does not resume at day 15.
Wait, really?
It restarts completely from day zero.
Wow. So that 20 days is a floor, not a ceiling.
Precisely. It is an absolute minimum. In reality, with a complex IPO, a company might receive 3 or 4 deficiency letters. The cooling off period can stretch into months.
So Frank and Ursula are sitting around for weeks, potentially months, just waiting for the SEC to bless their paperwork.
Right.
What are they actually allowed to do during this time? The exam loves to test the permitted and prohibited activities here.
They absolutely do.
So let's play a game of do's and don'ts. Let's start with the do's. What is legally permitted while they wait in purgatory?
The most important permitted activity is distributing a preliminary prospectus. In the industry, this is universally referred to as the red herring.
I would laugh at this name.
Mm-hmm.
Finance has some incredibly opaque terminology, but red herring sounds like an Agatha Christie novel. Why is it called that?
So it carries the business details, the management history, the financials, and all the risk factors from the S-1. It is meant to educate potential investors. But it gets its peculiar name because there is a prominent warning printed in red ink down the side of the cover page. That red text explicitly states that the registration statement has been filed but is not yet effective, and therefore the securities may not legally be sold yet.
I see. Okay, I want to flag a massive exam gotcha right here. Listen up. The test will describe a document circulating before the effective date, and it will ask you if it is a valid preliminary prospectus. Here is the question. Does the red herring have the final offering price printed on it?
Never, because Ursula hasn't finalized the price yet. She is using the red herring during her roadshow to gauge interest precisely so she can set the price.
Right.
The preliminary prospectus will only show a price range, something like estimated offering price, $14 to $16 per share.
So if an exam question describes a preliminary prospectus that features a firm final offering price of exactly $15 printed on the cover,
that document is illegal. It is a violation.
Boom. Okay, so distributing a red herring with a price range is a do-all. What else is permitted?
Publishing a tombstone advertisement.
Another uplifting, cheerful name from Wall Street.
Hey, it is exactly what it sounds like. It's a rigid, bare-bones announcement. It contains the absolute minimum facts, the name of the issuer, the type of security being offered, the number of shares, and the name of the underwriting syndicate.
That is it.
That is it. It does not offer any sales pitch. It does not describe the business model. And it is explicitly not an offer to sell. It just alerts the financial community that an offering is in the pipeline. Tombstones are permitted.
Permitted activity number three, collecting indications of interest. Let's test you, the listener, on this one. I am going to pose a scenario, and I want you to give it a beat and answer out loud. Ready?
This is a good one.
Let's say Ivan, the institutional investor, reads the red herring. He likes what he sees. He calls Ursula during the cooling off period and says, I am highly interested in these dolphin shoes. Put me down for 10,000 shares. 3 weeks later, the IPO goes live. The SEC declares it effective. Here is the question. Is Ivan legally bound to purchase those 10,000 shares?
Give it a beat.
If you said yes, you fell into the trap. The answer is absolutely, definitively, no.
An indication of interest is non-binding for all parties. It binds nobody.
So Ivan can just walk away.
He can walk away on the morning of the IPO and say, I changed my mind. I don't want them. And conversely, Ursula is not legally required to allocate those 10,000 shares to Ivan just because he raised his hand early.
Right.
Gathering indications of interest is simply a tool for Ursula to build an order book. It helps her gauge the depth of market demand so she can pinpoint that final offering price.
So any exam answer that treats an indication of interest as a firm commitment, a binding contract, or an actual order is completely wrong.
Completely wrong.
So those are the core do's. Red herring, tombstone, indications of interest. Let's flip the board. What are the don'ts? What is strictly prohibited during the cooling off period?
You cannot sell the security. Full stop. You cannot accept actual money. You cannot accept a binding order.
Simple enough.
Furthermore, you cannot distribute any advertising or promotional material that goes beyond the strict confines of the tombstone ad, and you absolutely cannot recommend the security or predict its future performance.
So I can't call my clients and say, hey, Frank's dolphin shoes are going to be the next Apple. They're going to the moon. Get ready.
You cannot. You are legally required to remain silent on predictions. The SEC views any hype as an attempt to circumvent the purpose of the prospectus, which is supposed to be a dry, factual disclosure of risk.
But there is one final ultimate trap during this phase, and it doesn't just apply to the cooling off period. It applies forever, even after the security is trading. It is what I call the SEC approval trap.
This is perhaps the most fundamental misunderstanding the general public has about the SEC, and the Series 66 exam will test you on it relentlessly.
Tell them the rule. Break it down for us.
A registration statement becoming effective means that the company has disclosed everything required by law. It means they filled out the paperwork correctly. It never, under any circumstances, means that the SEC has approved the offering or judged it to be a sound, high-quality investment.
I mean, this is so counterintuitive for people outside the industry. If the government reviews it for months, doesn't that imply it's safe?
Not at all. No. The SEC is a disclosure agency, not a merit agency. They do not care if Frank's motorized dolphin shoes represent the worst, most catastrophically flawed business idea in the history of capitalism.
No, really don't.
The SEC does not evaluate the quality, the viability, or the profitability of the investment. They only care that Frank told the absolute truth about how terrible it is.
So if Frank writes in his S-1, our product frequently catches fire, our CEO has no experience, our debt is crushing, and if you invest in us, you will likely lose 100% of your money. The SEC reads that and says, great, perfectly honest disclosure, your registration is effective.
Precisely. They do not protect investors from making bad investments. They protect investors from making uninformed investments.
Wow.
Because of this, telling a client or implying in any way that the SEC has approved an IPO or endorsed its quality is a severe, fireable regulatory violation.
Yeah, don't do that.
The front cover of every prospectus must contain a standard disclaimer stating that the SEC has not approved or disapproved of the securities. Any representation to the contrary is a criminal offense. Registration equals disclosure, not approval.
I love that. Registration equals disclosure, not approval. Okay, so let's move the timeline forward again. The 20 days, or realistically 3 months, are finally up.
Purgatory is over.
The SEC has no further comments. The offering is declared effective. Ursula finalized the price at $15. It is time to sell. But hold on, we have a massive structural problem to address here.
Risk.
Exactly, risk. Yeah. What if Ursula was wrong? What if she priced it at $15, but the morning of the IPO, a video goes viral of a motorized dolphin shoe malfunctioning in a pool and catching fire?
Oh, man.
Suddenly, nobody wants them. Ursula has millions of shares sitting there. Who eats the loss? Who's left holding the bag?
That entirely depends on the specific type of underwriting agreement that Frank and Ursula signed months ago. This agreement dictates who bears the financial risk of unsold shares, and you must know the variations for the exam.
I find the best way to memorize these is to think of underwriting like a retail supply chain. The first and most common type for major IPOs is called a firm commitment. I want you to think of this like a wholesale buyer.
In a firm commitment underwriting, Ursula's firm acts as a principal. They buy the entire allotment of shares directly from Frank's company at a slight discount. Let's say they pay him $14 a share.
Okay, so they write Frank a massive guaranteed check for the whole amount.
Yes. Frank is thrilled. He has his money, his risk is eliminated, and he goes off to Nevada to build his factory. Ursula's firm now owns those shares in their own inventory.
Right.
She then turns around and attempts to resell them to the public at the full $15 offering price, keeping that $1 spread as her profit.
So Ursula is the wholesale buyer taking on inventory risk. Let's run the disaster scenario. She buys 10 million shares from Frank. The viral video hits. She can only manage to sell 5 million shares to the public. What happens to the other 5 million?
Ursula's firm eats the loss. She owns those unsold shares. The risk has shifted entirely from the issuer to the underwriter. She might have to dump them on the open market at $5 a share and take a massive write-down.
Ouch.
Yeah. The memory aid here is right in the name. Firm equals firm guarantee. The underwriter guarantees the funds to the issuer, buys the shares into their own inventory, and bears all the risk.
Now let's contrast that with the alternative, best efforts. If firm commitment is a wholesale buyer, I want you to think of best efforts as a consignment shop.
That is the perfect analogy. In a best efforts underwriting, Ursula acts as an agent, not a principal. She does not buy the shares. She does not guarantee Frank a dime.
What does she tell him?
She simply tells Frank, look, this dolphin shoe concept is highly speculative. I am not risking my firm's capital on it. I will use my network to try my absolute best to sell these shares for you, but whatever I can't sell, I'm handing right back to you.
So she operates like a broker, just trying to match buyers to Frank's shares. Mm-hmm. If she only sells half the shares, what happens?
Frank only gets half the money. The unsold shares remain with the issuer. Therefore, in a best efforts agreement, the issuer bears the risk of not raising the required capital.
So firm commitment. Underwriter takes the risk, best efforts. Issuer takes the risk. That is the baseline.
Right.
But the Series 66 writers are not going to just ask you the baseline, are they? They love to throw the variations at you. Let's dissect the most dangerous one, all or none.
This is a major exam trap. An all or none offering stipulates that either 100% of the shares are sold to the public or the entire offering is canceled and everyone gets their money back.
Okay, so it's conditional?
Very. During the selling period, as Ursula collects funds from investors, that money does not go to Frank. It is placed into a neutral escrow account at a separate bank.
Why does the exam love this specific variation? Because the phrase all or none sounds incredibly absolute. It sounds like a firm guarantee.
Yep.
But let me ask you, what broad category of underwriting is all or none actually a subset of?
It is a subset of best efforts.
Why? That feels completely backwards based on the name?
It feels backwards until you look at who is holding the risk. Remember our defining question. Does the underwriter buy the shares?
No.
Exactly. In an all or none, Ursula does not buy the shares. She is not writing Frank a check. She is acting as an agent, trying her best to sell all of them.
Ah, I see.
If she fails, even if she sells 99% of them, the deal is canceled, the escrow account refunds the investors, and Frank goes home with zero capital.
So Ursula loses her time and effort, but she doesn't lose her own capital.
Right. Frank is the one who suffers the failure to raise funds.
Yeah.
Because the underwriter doesn't guarantee the capital, the issuer bears the risk, making it a best efforts variation. Do not let the rigid language trick you.
That is brilliant. Trace the risk, trace the dollars. What about the mini-maxi variation?
This is another subset of best efforts, operating similarly to all or none, but with a threshold. Frank might say, I need an absolute minimum of $5 million to make this factory viable. If you can't raise at least $5 million, cancel the whole thing and refund the escrow.
And if she does hit five?
If you hit $5 million, keep selling up to a maximum of $20 million. Again, Ursula doesn't buy the shares herself. The issuer bears the risk of falling short of the minimum.
And lastly, standby underwriting.
Standby is a unique animal. It is utilized specifically in rights offerings. When a publicly traded company issues preemptive rights to its existing shareholders, allowing them to buy newly issued stock at a discount to maintain their proportionate ownership, the company faces a risk.
Which is, what if the existing shareholders don't want to buy more stock?
Exactly. What if they don't exercise their rights? The company still needs the capital. So they hire an underwriter to stand by. The underwriter signs an agreement saying, whatever shares your existing stockholders leave on the table, we will buy.
Oh.
Because the underwriter is firmly committing to purchase the leftovers into their own inventory, the underwriter bears the risk. Standby is a variation of firm commitment.
Okay, let's fast forward our narrative. The IPO was a massive success. Ursula sold every single share in a firm commitment. Frank's company is officially public.
They did it.
The stock is trading on the NASDAQ under the ticker symbol FLAP. Frank is rich beyond his wildest dreams on paper. He opens his brokerage app, looks at his founder shares, and sees a balance of $200 million. So my question to you, the listener, is why doesn't Frank just smash the sell all button on day one, liquidate his entire position on the open market, and go buy a private island in the Caribbean?
Give him a second to think about it.
Because he is bound by a lockup period.
Ah, yes. The great restrictor of founder dreams.
What exactly is the lockup period?
The lockup period is a legally binding agreement that prevents insiders. This includes Frank the founder, the executive officers, the board of directors, and often the early venture capital investors, from selling any of their existing shares for a specified time frame immediately following the IPO.
How long is it usually?
It is typically 90 to 180 days, with 180 days, 6 months, being the industry standard.
But it's Frank's company. He built the dolphin shoes with his bare hands in a garage. Why is he blocked from cashing out?
Think about the basic economics of supply and demand that govern the secondary market. What would happen if Frank, his CFO, and all his early VC backers decided to dump 30 million shares onto the open market at 9.31 a.m. on the first day of trading?
The available supply of the stock would skyrocket instantly.
Exactly. And when supply vastly overwhelms demand, the price craters, it would completely tank the stock.
Well, that makes sense.
Imagine you are Retail Randy or Ivan the Institutional Investor. You just bought into this IPO at $15 a share. And an hour later, the founder dumps his entire position and crashes the price to $3. You would be furious and you would never trust that underwriter again.
Never again.
The lockup period acts as a stabilizing mechanism. It prevents the market from being flooded with supply, giving the stock time to find its natural equilibrium and build a track record in the public markets without insider interference.
That makes total sense from a market stability standpoint.
But here comes the exam gotcha. Pay close attention to this nuance. Is this six-month lockup period a strict SEC regulation?
It is not. This is one of those frequently missed questions on the exam.
People always assume it's a law.
Right. But the insider lockup period is a contractual agreement strictly between the insiders, like Frank, and the lead underwriter, Ursula. Ursula demands this contract be signed before she will ever agree to underwrite the IPO.
She does it to protect her clients and her firm's reputation. Yes. It is a private contract, not a federal securities law mandated by the SEC.
I want to clarify something there, because some test takers might read a FINRA rule and get confused.
Right. FINRA does have specific rules regarding the lockup of shares that are given to underwriters as compensation for doing the deal. But when the exam asks about the general insider lockup period restricting founders and early investors, the one you read about in the Wall Street Journal, that is a contract.
Okay, so Frank waits. Six grueling months pass. The lockup expires. Frank is finally free. He calls up his broker and says, sell 5 million of my personal shares to the public immediately. This brings us to one of the most important, highly tested, and heavily misunderstood topics in the entire unit, secondary offerings.
This is critical. Frank is now selling his own personal shares to the public on the open market.
Direct question to you, the listener. Pause what you are doing and think about the mechanics of this transaction. Frank is selling 5 million shares to the public. Does Frank's company get the money from this massive sale? Absolutely not. Frank gets the money. The company gets nothing.
This highlights the fundamental difference between primary and secondary offerings, and you must be able to contrast them side by side for the exam. Let's review.
Let's do it.
In a primary offering, the company, the issuer, is the entity creating new shares and selling them. Therefore, the company receives the proceeds. In a secondary offering, an existing shareholder like Frank or a venture capital firm is selling their already existing, already issued shares to someone else.
And the selling shareholder pockets the cash.
Exactly. The corporate treasury receives absolutely nothing.
So, to summarize the timeline, when Frank does his IPO in January, it's a primary offering. The company gets $100 million to build a factory in Nevada. When Frank sells his personal shares 6 months later in July, it's a secondary offering. Frank gets $15 million to buy his yacht.
Perfectly stated. Now let's tackle the concept of dilution again, because they will test your understanding of how these offerings impact the balance sheet. Does a primary offering dilute the percentage ownership of existing shareholders?
Yes, unequivocally, because the company is literally creating brand new shares out of thin air. The total pie is getting bigger, which means everyone's existing slice now represents a smaller percentage of the total company.
Correct. Now, does a secondary offering dilute the existing shareholders?
No, because no new shares are being created. Frank is simply transferring ownership of his existing slice of the pie to retail Randy.
Right.
If there were 50 million shares outstanding before Frank's sale, there are still exactly 50 million shares outstanding after his sale. The pie didn't change size. Secondary offerings are strictly non-dilutive.
We really need to clear up some persistent media confusion here, because the financial news anchors often get this terminology wrong, and the Series 66 exam is rigid about legal definitions.
Well, they mess it up constantly.
Often you will turn on a financial network and hear a pundit say, Tesla is doing a secondary offering to raise capital for a new gigafactory.
Which makes my eye twitch, because it is legally completely wrong.
Right. Let's break down why. If a public company decides to issue new shares to raise capital after their initial IPO, that is legally classified as a follow-on offering or a seasoned equity offering.
Right.
Because the company is issuing new shares and the company is getting the money into its treasury to build that gigafactory, a follow-on offering is a primary offering. And because new shares are created, it is dilutive.
The media calls it a secondary offering simply because it happens second chronologically after the IPO.
Yeah.
They're using the word in a temporal sense. But on the exam, you have to ignore chronological timing entirely. When you see the word secondary, you only ask one question. Who gets the money?
Exactly. Trace the dollars. Who gets the money? If the issuer gets it, it's primary. If an existing shareholder gets it, it's secondary. Now, just to make sure you are fully prepared for the most complex scenarios, you should know that sometimes an offering combines both structures simultaneously.
Wait, how does a combined offering work mechanically?
Imagine Frank's company needs capital, but Frank also wants a new house. The company wants to raise $10 million for R&D, and Frank personally wants to sell $5 million of his own stock.
Okay.
Instead of doing two separate roadshows, they combine it. They go to the public market to sell $15 million worth of stock in a single, unified offering.
So if a test question presents a combined offering, how do you categorize it? Does it dilute or not?
You split it cleanly based on where the proceeds go. The $10 million portion where new shares are created and the money flows into the corporate treasury is the primary portion. That specific portion dilutes the existing shareholder base.
Got it.
The $5 million portion where Frank sells his existing shares and pockets the cash is the secondary portion. That part does not dilute. You literally just trace the dollars to their final destination to determine the impact.
Trace the dollars. I love it. Okay, I want you to take a deep breath, shake it out, grab a sip of coffee. Because everything we just painstakingly learned about this careful, highly regulated process, the months of grueling due diligence, the massive S1 filings, Ursula analyzing financials, the SEC enforcing strict cooling off periods to protect investors.
We are about to toss it out the window.
We are tossing it out the window and doing it completely backwards.
We are leaving the highly structured world of traditional underwriting and entering the wild west of modern finance. Welcome to the era of SPACs. Special purpose acquisition companies.
I feel like we need to build a bridge here to explain why SPACs even exist. If the IPO process is the gold standard, why invent something else?
Well, the reality is that Ursula's process is exhausting.
Yeah. The roadshows, the SEC scrutiny, the sheer cost of investment banking fees, and the risk of the market tanking during the cooling off period, it is a massive burden on a private company. Wall Street, in its infinite creativity, wanted a back door. They wanted a faster, easier way to take a company public, so they invented the SPAC.
To understand this backdoor, we need to introduce our final character, Sponsor Sam. Now, Sponsor Sam is fundamentally different from Frank. Sam doesn't have a factory. He doesn't have a patent for motorized dolphin shoes.
He doesn't have anything.
He doesn't have a product, any revenue, any employees, or any business operations whatsoever. All Sponsor Sam has is a really expensive suit, an Ivy League resume, a Rolodex of rich friends, and a promise that he is a genius at finding good deals.
Sponsor Sam is basically a walking concept. He is creating a shell company. A SPAC is literally defined as a blank check company. Investors are being asked to buy shares without having any idea what underlying business they will ultimately own.
It sounds absurd on its face, but it became a multi-hundred billion dollar industry. Let's walk through the mechanics of how this backwards IPO actually works stage by stage, because the exam will test your understanding of the timeline.
Stage one, the SPAC IPO.
Sponsor Sam takes his empty, operationalless shell company public through a traditional IPO process. But because there is no business to evaluate, the S-1 filing is incredibly thin. It basically just says, give me money and I will find something to buy.
Right.
Retail Randy and Ivan, the institutional investor, buy shares in this shell company. The industry standard is that these shares, or units, are priced at exactly $10 each. They hand Sponsor Sam their money.
Wait, let me stop you, because a rational person would ask. They just hand a guy with no business hundreds of millions of dollars. Does Sam just put that in his checking account? Where does the money actually go?
That leads us to stage two, capital and trust. This is a critical investor protection. All of those IPO proceeds from Randy and Ivan are immediately placed into a strict interest-bearing trust account.
Okay, good.
It is typically invested entirely in ultra-safe short-term U.S. treasuries. Sponsor Sam cannot touch this money. He cannot use it to buy a yacht. He cannot use it to pay his own salary. And he cannot use it to rent a lavish office. It sits there, locked up and insulated.
Okay, so the public's money is safe in escrow. Then what?
Stage three, the target search. The clock starts ticking. Sam is usually granted a window of 18 to 24 months, dictated by the SPAC's governing charter, to go out into the real world and find a legitimate private operating company to acquire.
So Sam is wandering around Silicon Valley or Wall Street looking for Frank's dolphin shoe company or a space tourism startup or an electric vehicle manufacturer. He is shopping with a massive locked wallet.
Precisely. And if he finds a target company that agrees to be bought, we reach stage four, the de-SPAC transaction. This is the magical backdoor.
The de-SPAC.
Yes, the empty, already public shell company merges with the private target company. Through the mechanics of this merger, the private target instantly absorbs the public ticker symbol and becomes a publicly traded company.
Ah, so Frank gets to bypass Ursula's whole grueling six-month IPO process. He skips the exhausting roadshow, and he just merges with Sam's empty shell to become public overnight.
Exactly. It's a faster route to the public markets with a guaranteed pile of cash waiting in the trust account.
But let's run the ultimate scenario. What if Sam spends 23 months searching, looks at 100 companies, and can't find anything worth buying? What if the 24-month clock runs out?
Stage five, liquidation. If the deadline hits and no acquisition has been consummated, the SPAC is forced to dissolve. That trust account is cracked open, and all the funds, plus the accrued interest from the U.S. treasuries, are returned pro rata to the investors.
Wow.
Retail Randy gets his $10 a share back, plus maybe a few cents of interest.
I am going to put myself in Retail Randy's shoes for a second. When you explain it like that, this sounds like an incredible risk-free proposition. I give Sam $10. If he finds the next DraftKings or Virgin Galactic, the stock rockets to $30 and I'm rich. If he fails to find anything, I get my $10 back. Heads I win, tails I tie. Where is the catch? Why do SPACs have such a controversial, toxic reputation in the financial press?
The catch is the hidden structural risk of massive dilution. And this is the core concept you must grasp about SPACs. It comes down to a mechanism known as the promote.
The promote. Let's unpack this, because this is where the math gets wild. Sam didn't start this shell company out of the goodness of his heart. He wants to get rich. How does he get paid if he can't touch the trust money?
Sponsor Sam compensates himself by taking founder shares. This is his reward for organizing the structure, putting the deal together, and sourcing the target. The industry standard is that the sponsor gets 20% of the total post-IPO shares of the SPAC.
Okay, 20%.
But here is the critical kicker that changes everything. He gets them for a purely nominal cost.
Define nominal for me in this context. Give me the real math.
Let's run a simplified scenario. Imagine the public investors, retail Randy and Ivan, put $200 million into the trust account. They did this by buying 20 million shares at $10 each. They own 80% of the shell company.
Right.
Sponsor Sam, as his promote, gets the remaining 20%, which equates to 5 million shares. But Sam doesn't pay $10 a share. He might pay a grand total of $25,000 for all 5 million shares.
Let me freeze time. The public paid $200 million for their 80% slice, and Sponsor Sam paid 25 grand for his 20% slice. He is paying fractions of a penny per share.
Exactly. It is a massive structural disparity. Now, you might argue, well, his founder shares don't have any claim on the cash in the trust account if the SPAC liquidates, so who cares what he paid?
Right. If they fail, he loses his 25 grand.
And that is true before the merger. But the math violently changes after the de-SPAC merger. What happens when they finally buy Frank's company?
Right. Once the merger is complete, the shell company disappears, and Sam's 5 million founder shares convert into regular common stock of the new combined company.
Yes. They convert on a one-to-one basis, side by side with the public shares, and they come into the new company at essentially zero cost. Think about what that means for retail Randy.
It's terrible for him.
Even if Sponsor Sam finds a fantastic, profitable target company, the public investors who paid 10 hard-earned dollars a share are instantly, massively diluted by Sam's 20% slice that he got for pennies. The pie was carved up and a huge piece was given away before the real business even arrived on the scene. That dilution is the true hidden cost of investing in a SPAC.
And it creates a perverse incentive. If Sam is facing month 23 and he hasn't found a good company, he is financially incentivized to buy a terrible company.
Why is that?
Because if he liquidates, his $25,000 promote expires worthless. If he merges with a terrible company, his 20% slice might still be worth tens of millions of dollars when he dumps it on the open market, even if the stock drops from $10 to $5.
You have hit the nail on the head. That misalignment of incentives is why regulators scrutinize them so heavily. The exam takeaway here is clear. SPAC investors are betting entirely on the sponsor's deal-making ability and reputation, not on an existing business model. And the sponsor's promote is the ultimate source of extreme baked-in dilution.
This brings up a massive regulatory contradiction that I need you to explain. If a SPAC is just a shell company raising capital without a specific business plan, doesn't the SEC have strict rules against exactly that? I was looking at the history of the 1980s, and the market was plagued by blank check fraud. Penny stock operators would raise money for shell companies and just steal it. Didn't the SEC outlaw that?
They didn't outlaw it, but they regulated it fiercely. You are referencing the penny stock blank check rules. The SEC has a very specific framework designed to prevent exactly the kind of fraud you saw in the 80s.
Let's break down this framework. What happens if a normal company tries to do what Sam is doing?
If a blank check company is issuing what is legally defined as a penny stock, which generally means a stock priced below $5 a share, the SEC imposes incredibly strict, burdensome requirements.
What kind of requirements? Give me the teeth of the rule.
There are four main pillars to the penny stock blank check rule. First, investor funds absolutely must be held in an escrow or trust account. Second, when the promoters finally find a target to acquire, that target company must have a fair value equal to at least 80% of the maximum offering proceeds.
Okay, that prevents a promoter from raising $100 million and then buying his buddy's hot dog stand just to complete a merger.
Exactly. It forces a real acquisition. Third, and this is the most powerful investor protection, once a target is found and announced, the investors are not automatically rolled into the new company. They are sent a prospectus detailing the target, and they have 20 to 45 days to actively reconfirm their investment in writing.
In writing.
If an investor does not physically return a signed document saying, yes, I read the details and I still want to invest, their silence is legally treated as a no, and they automatically get their money refunded from escrow.
That is huge. They have to opt into the merger rather than opt out.
Correct. And the fourth pillar is a strict 18-month deadline to consummate a deal, or the escrow is automatically refunded.
Wait, let's pause here. Let me put the pieces together. You just said SPACs usually have 18 to 24 months to find a deal, not a strict 18.
I did say that.
And more importantly, I know for a fact that SPAC investors do not have to reconfirm in writing. When a SPAC announces a target, if retail Randy does nothing, he stays invested. he has to actively file paperwork to redeem his shares and opt out. It's the exact opposite of the SEC rule you just described.
Yep.
So my question is, why doesn't Sponsor Sam have to follow these strict SEC penny stock rules?
This is a brilliant, deep-in-the-weeds regulatory nuance that makes for a fantastic high-level exam question. How do SPACs legally escape the SEC's penny stock blank check rule?
Well, let me guess, based on the definitions, you just said the rule applies to penny stocks, which are usually priced under $5. SPACs standardize their IPO price at $10 a share. So they escape simply because their price is too high, right? 10 is greater than 5.
It seems perfectly logical, but it is completely incorrect. And this is the exact gotcha the test writers will use.
Really?
Yes. The normal SEC rule that states if a stock is priced over $5, it is excluded from being a penny stock, is explicitly legally turned off for blank check companies. You cannot use the $5 price exclusion to escape the blank check rules.
Oh, wow. So the SEC foresaw that loophole. They knew promoters would just price their shell companies at $6 to avoid the rules. So even at $10 a share, Sam SPAC would normally be trapped by these strict regulations. So how does he actually escape?
Sam escapes through a different exclusion entirely.
Yeah.
He escapes because he listed his SPAC on a national securities exchange, like the New York Stock Exchange or the NASDAQ.
Ah, the prestige loophole.
Exactly. The SEC regulations contain another exclusion. If a stock is approved for listing on a major national securities exchange, it is exempt from the definition of a penny stock, regardless of its underlying business.
That's crazy.
That exchange listing exclusion works for blank check companies, even though the $5 price exclusion does not. The SEC assumes that the rigorous listing standards, capitalization requirements, and corporate governance oversight provided by the NASDAQ or NYSE offer a sufficient substitute for the strict penny stock rules.
Okay, I see.
So by paying the fees and jumping through the hoops to list on the NASDAQ, Sam SPAC legally avoids being classified as a penny stock blank check company. Therefore, he bypasses the mandatory written opt-in requirement.
That is wild. He uses the institutional prestige of the exchange to bypass the strictest retail protections.
He does. Now, to be fair to the industry, it is important to note that even though they escape the strict legal mandate, modern SPACs voluntarily adopt many similar mechanisms in their corporate charters to attract investors.
Right, because otherwise nobody would buy them.
Right. They still use trust accounts and they still set deadlines, but they do it through private corporate governance, not because the SEC penny stock rule is forcing them to.
Okay, that is a dense, incredibly testable nuance. If you're taking notes, write this down. For blank check companies, the $5 penny stock exclusion is turned off F. The national exchange listing exclusion is the escape hatch.
That is the exact takeaway.
Wow. We have covered a massive amount of ground today. We took Frank's motorized dolphin shoes from a private garage dream to a fully regulated public reality. We dragged Ursula through due diligence, and we watched Sam hack the system with a SPAC. Let's land this plane. It is time for the rapid-fire recap. I am going to sprint through the top five highly testable takeaways from everything we dissected today. Ready?
Let's hear it.
Number one, primary versus secondary. IPOs are primary offerings because the issuer gets paid and new shares are created, which causes dilution. Secondary offerings pay existing shareholders, like Frank, selling his personal stake. And they are not dilutive because no new shares are created. Always trace the dollars to see who gets paid. Number two, underwriting commitments dictate who holds the bag. Firm commitment means the underwriter acts as a principal, buys the shares into their own inventory, and takes the risk. Best efforts means the underwriter acts as an agent, and the issuer retains the risk. And do not forget the trap. All or none sounds like a firm guarantee, but it is actually a type of best efforts where the issuer holds the risk and funds sit in escrow.
Right. Don't let the absolute language of all or none trick you.
Number three, the 20-day cooling off period. During this time, distributing red herrings with price ranges, publishing tombstones, and collecting non-binding indications of interest are permitted. But taking money, confirming orders, predicting performance, or implying that the SEC approved the offering is a massive fireable violation.
Registration equals disclosure, not approval. The SEC does not judge the merit of the investment.
Number four, lockup periods. They exist to prevent insiders from dumping shares and crashing the price on day one, but they are private contracts negotiated between the underwriter and the insiders, not federal SEC laws.
Contractual agreement, not regulatory mandate.
And finally, number five, SPACs. They are empty shell companies that go public first, hold the money in trust, and then have 18 to 24 months to find a target to merge with. and the sponsors promote that massive 20% equity slice they get for pennies is the ultimate source of hidden dilution for the retail investor.
That covers the core mechanics beautifully.
Awesome. Now, before we let you go to crush your practice exams, we want to leave you with a final thought, a philosophical puzzle to chew on while you review these regulations.
Think about the evolution of the public capital markets that we just traced over the last hour. We went from the traditional IPO model, where Ursula demands months of audited financials, agonizing due diligence, and absolute transparency just to allow a company to access public money, to the modern SPAC era.
It's quite a leap.
In the SPAC era, the market gladly hands over hundreds of millions of dollars to an empty shell company with literally zero operations, based on nothing but sponsor Sam's resume and a promise to find something good.
It is a staggering shift in market psychology when you put it like that.
It truly is. The prevailing argument from Wall Street is that SPACs democratize capital. Yeah. The argument is that they allow everyday folks, like Retail Randy, to get in on the ground floor of an exciting acquisition, a stage of investing that used to be guarded behind velvet ropes, reserved exclusively for private equity billionaires and venture capitalists.
Right.
But the question you have to ask yourself, especially now that you understand the underlying math, is this. Does this democratization actually empower the retail investor? Or does the complex structure of the promote, the hidden dilution, and the misaligned incentives just create a newer, more creative way for founders and Wall Street sponsors to extract wealth from the public?
Is Retail Randy actually getting a seat at the table, or is he just the meal being served to sponsor Sam?
Exactly. Something to think about as you navigate these rules, because the regulations you are memorizing for this exam aren't just arbitrary roadblocks. They are the guardrails attempting to balance the need for financial innovation against the absolute necessity of investor protection.
I love that. A puzzle to keep your brain engaged with the material. Remember, when you sit down in that testing center and stare at a convoluted Series 66 question, just close your eyes. Picture Frank's dolphin shoes catching fire. Picture Ursula's stress as she drafts the S-1 and always trace the dollars. You've got this. Keep crushing your studying, and we will see you on the next deep dive.